I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. An interesting and important book was published a month ago in the midst of the federal election campaign. The author made a plea in that campaign it was necessary to talk about to think about the Supreme Court of Canada, as the next Prime Minister would have to appoint at least four judges to it, thus shaping or reshaping Canada in the process years down the line, long after the Prime Minister was gone from office. See, the Supreme Court of Canada, other than being an arbiter of cases that make its way to the highest court of the land, the court in recent years, since the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, has decided many laws in the absence of our politicians. References to the Supreme Court often decide the limits of policy and law. And since the election, two Supreme Court justices have announced their retirement, bringing the number of judges who could be appointed by Stephen Harper to at least five. The author of Mighty Judgment, How the Supreme Court Runs Your Life, joins me now. Philip Slayton is the best-selling author of Lawyers Gone Bad and writes for Canadian Lawyer magazine. He is a Rhodes Scholar and was a law clerk on the Supreme Court. He retired in 2000 as a senior partner at the firm Blake, Castles & Graydon. His website is at philipslayton.com. The book is published by Allen Lane, which is an imprint of Penguin. I've also become a fast fan of the Gab and Dad movie reviews he does on YouTube. Please welcome to the Planta Online program in Vancouver this day, Philip Slayton. Good morning, Mr. Slayton.
Good morning, Joe. Nice to be here. And I'm glad for the plug for Gab and Dad. My daughter, Gab, will be very pleased, too.
How long have you guys been doing that?
We've been doing it now about 2 years. It's sort of a little hobby, really. We're both movie fans, and we go to the movies together a lot. And one day we got this idea of posting reviews, and we get a lot of fun out of it. Sometimes my grandson, Max, who is almost nine, joins us, so it's kind of an intergenerational thing. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
We have about 2,000 subscribers.
Yeah, that's a lot for YouTube, isn't it?
Well, some people have a huge number,
yeah.
So it's respectable.
Yeah, it is. People listening to us will... people know about the Supreme Court, but they know little on what goes on there. So,
yeah, I mean, I would even say that most Canadians, know almost nothing about the Supreme Court of Canada,
right.
And that, of course, is one of the reasons why I wrote the book, to try and give people a fairly easy and entertaining way of finding something about it.
So the basic premise of the court is that these are cases that go to it from lower courts, I guess, on appeal, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of things here, Joe. The first is that the Supreme Court of Canada is the final court of the land. So if there's some kind of legal dispute of one kind or another, if it finds its way to the Supreme Court, and most, of course, don't, but if it does, whatever the Supreme Court of Canada decides, that's it. There's no place else to go. So that's one thing. But the other thing is that since 1982, when the Charter of Rights and Freedoms became part of our Constitution, the court has had this huge power to strike down provincial or federal legislation, and just more generally to find that things that are done are contrary to the very general principles in the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. And this has given them a huge power, huge discretion to really reshape the social, economic, and political nature of this country.
So when something like, at least in my case, I heard of references to the Supreme Court in the late 90s, I guess, growing up. The Clarity Act was something that was talked a lot about. That was brought to the court for reference so that they would decide whether it was constitutional or not, right?
Yes, I mean, the reference function of the Supreme Court is really a bit of an oddity. What it means is that the federal government can refer to the Supreme Court some issue of a legal or quasi-legal nature for them to, in a sense, decide. It's really asking for a legal opinion. So let me just pick out three, for example, fairly recent times that are important. One was the reference re same-sex marriage, when the federal government said to the Supreme Court of Canada, is it constitutional to have legislation which provides for people of the same sex to marry? And the Supreme Court of Canada said, yes, it was. Another was, and this is one you were just referring to, was the Quebec secession reference, when the federal government asked the Supreme Court, is it legal for Quebec to secede, and if so, on what kind of grounds and according to what process? And then there's a third one that is before the court right now. I'm just sort of picking more or less at random now.
Mm-hmm.
and that is national securities regulator. The federal government wants a national securities regulator. Several provinces are opposed to it, notably Quebec, Alberta, Saskatchewan. And so the federal government has punted this issue to the Supreme Court and said, can we have a national securities regulator? That's a kind of an odd function for the Supreme Court to perform. It's not deciding disputes as such. It's not deciding disputes that have come up through the lower courts. It's really acting as a superior giver of legal advice and opinion.
And that's unique to Canada compared to other countries?
I think it is. I'm not aware of any other, certainly Western jurisdiction, where the highest court in the land fulfills that function. And I might say, by the way, that at least some judges of the Supreme Court are not enamored of this role. They feel it's an anomaly. They feel that often the questions sent to them, and it doesn't happen all that often, but often the questions sent to them are really political questions that should be solved in the political arena. That said, many of the judges of the Supreme Court have said of the Quebec secession reference that it was the Supreme Court's finest hour and the most important judgment they ever rendered.
Now, the idea that sort of judges know better than, say, elected officials, in light of the recent election and some of the MPs that have been elected, you know, thinking of the woman from Quebec who, the bartender, you know what I mean? Like,
it's a democracy, yeah. You know, anybody can go and represent the people.
But some people will say, you know, that perhaps, you know, the nine judges of the Supreme Court of Canada have a lot more, I don't know, judgment than say Ruth Ellen Brousseau.
Well, I mean, it is true to say this, that I mean, the way the Supreme Court of Canada decides an issue is by studying very extensive written arguments put before them, by then hearing oral arguments, people arguing the various sides in front of them, then deliberating at great length and coming to a reasoned decision, and then writing down extensively why they've decided the way they've decided and giving it to all of us to read if we want to do so and figure it out. I mean, that's a responsible and impressive way of deciding disputes, and some might think it's preferable to having not terribly well-informed people yell at each other across the floor of the House of Commons. However, this is a democracy. And there's a very kind of strong argument that says in a democracy, political issues should be decided by people who are elected. Whether they decide the issues well or not, that's another issue, but it's a democracy and that's what should happen. And there is something worrying about having nine unelected government officials who are there for a long time that we can't kick out if we don't like what they do, decide hugely important issues for all of us.
Now, when the Charter of Rights and Freedoms came into being, and it was a month old when that happened in 1982, so I'm wondering, did the people that crafted that, did they envision how it would change the country as it has?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, as much as anybody's, it was Pierre Trudeau, as much as anybody's work, of course. I don't know if they realized the huge impact it would have. I mean, I mean, you were just born when this happened. I, at that time, was the dean of a law school in this country, and I certainly didn't realize the enormous impact it was going to have. I'm not sure that people really had a full grasp of its implications, but it's certainly been an enormously important piece of our Constitution. It's proven itself to be that, and it proved itself to be that quite early on.
And the politicians abdicating the role as legislators, was that something that, I mean, is that something that they knew was going to happen? Or
I don't think so, but I think what has happened in this country, and I regard it as a disturbing trend, is that many issues that are really political issues, certainly in my opinion, are political issues, and should be decided by elected politicians sitting around a table negotiating, because that's what happens in a democracy. Those issues are increasingly recharacterized as legal issues, often Charter of Rights and Freedoms issues, and instead of being negotiated by elected politicians, argued about before judges and decided by non-elected judges. Now, some issues really are legal issues, but not every issue is a legal issue. Many of them are political issues and should be decided, in my opinion, by politicians.
Now, you mentioned that some justices like this role that they have. I mean, we have nine justices currently on the Supreme Court. Okay. I mean, they're all pretty responsible, and they have been, haven't they?
Oh, certainly they're all responsible. I mean, they're all responsible, hardworking, intelligent, well-educated people. That's no question about that. But like any cross-section of people, they have different views. I mean, some may be more left of center, more interested in human rights and civil liberties, that sort of thing. For example, Rosie Abella would be certainly fit into that category. Others may be more conservative, right of center, have a less generous view of civil rights, be more interested in law and order than the rights of the criminally accused, and so on. And I think one point about the upcoming appointments to the Supreme Court that you mentioned at the beginning of this conversation, namely that Prime Minister Harper is going to get to pick a lot of judges over the next few years, one point about that is he's likely, I would say, almost inevitable to pick people that he believes will be sympathetic to his right-of-center view on many issues, because he doesn't want his legislative program being torpedoed before the Supreme Court of Canada. So the chances are that you'll see in that court a move to the right. There'll still all be, you know, fine, upstanding, responsible, and intelligent judges, but nonetheless they'll have views, and I think you'll find that those views will increasingly be a right-of-center. Now, some people like that, and some people don't. It depends on your point of view, obviously.
I'll get to the appointments that Mr. Harper will have to fill in a sec, but just thinking about the view that judges have, the judges on the Supreme Court at least, when they render their judgments, do they realize that whatever they're saying has, import long-term as well, not just at the moment that the judgment's handed in?
Oh, I think so. I think absolutely so. I mean, I think that certainly the modern-day judge on the Supreme Court of Canada absolutely understands that they are making very important general pronouncements, not just deciding some kind of particular dispute before them, but making very important general pronouncements that will have a very important general effect right across this country for a long time to come. They certainly understand that. I mean, the Chief Justice, for example, Beverly McLaughlin, has said, and other judges have said, that the Supreme Court of Canada is not there to fix mistakes made by the courts below, the traditional appellate function. They're not there to do that. They are there to lay down legal and other policies. So they fully understand that.
Now, the recent announcements of the retirements of Justice Binney and Chiron.
Yes.
You mentioned in the book that, I think you mentioned in the book, I'm not sure, but Justice Binney was, I guess he's 70, right?
I think he's 71 now.
Yeah, but Justice Chiron is not.
She's 60.
Yeah, was that retirement expected? I guess not.
No, I mean, Binney in a sense is not unexpected. He's been on the court, I think, for 14 years now. He's 71. It's a tough job, and I suspect that Justice Binney would like to return to the legal flesh parts of Toronto while he's still welcome there. So that's understandable, I suppose. Chiron's a different kettle of fish. I mean, she's been on the court 7 years, I think. She's 60. She has 15 years to go before she must retire at the age of 75, and yet she's going so much earlier. Why? I certainly don't know. There may be a story there, perhaps, that some canny investigative reporter can track down. I just don't know.
You mentioned in the book, though, that there is a lot of burnout.
Yes, there is. It's not unusual for a judge to leave some years before the mandatory retirement age of 75. Not unusual at all. To leave at 60 is perhaps a bit unusual, although the last judge to do that, Michel Bastarache, who was replaced by Thomas Cromwell, he was, I think, 62 when he left. So there is something of a precedent there. I mean, it is, Joe, a tough job. You know, it's a demanding job. The issues are complicated. There are long hours to put in. These people are young people. But on the other hand, it's a wonderful job if you're interested in the law and legal policy. And I find it a bit curious that certainly that Louise Chiron has left when she's left. Maybe somebody will come up with some explanation in due course.
And the process in selecting the replacements, will the opposition have a say in that?
Well, the Prime Minister has announced that he's going to follow more or less the same process that was followed for, in a sort of a shortened form, for Tom Cromwell and before that for Marshall Rostin, which is, there will be an all-party committee composed of members of the House of Commons who will look at lists and come up with a short list, which will go back to the Prime Minister. This committee is purely advisory, of course. It has no formal power or authority. The Prime Minister will then decide who he wants, and that person will apparently appear before, in public, before a parliamentary committee, as did Marshall Rostin, the first judge ever to do that. But none of that process, none of those committees have any power to do anything. They can't reject a nominee by the Prime Minister. They can't decide who gets to be the judge. Whatever window dressing you have, at the end of the day, this decision is the decision of the Prime Minister and his decision alone.
And what would you suggest in terms of reforming the process of selecting a replacement?
Well, I like the American system. As you know, in the United States, the president nominates someone to fill a vacancy on the U.S. Supreme Court, and that candidate then has to be confirmed or not, as the case may be, by the Senate of the United States, following public hearings and a recommendation by the Senate Judiciary Committee. It's a very democratic process. It's very transparent. It unfolds over quite a long period of time, so the general public, the press, and everybody has lots of opportunity to find out who this candidate is, and publicize what he or she has done in the past. I like that process as compared to the unilateral choice by the Prime Minister in this country, really surrounded by secrecy, so that more often than not, the first thing that you or I know about it is when we read about it in the newspaper.
Isn't the American process, so that, I mean, that's a bit of a circus. You get.
Well, that's what people say. They say, oh, it's circus, it's terrible. They ask these candidates embarrassing questions. And that is true. And those of us, this doesn't include you, of course, but those of us who are somewhat older, we remember the infamous Clarence Thomas hearings, which Clarence Thomas himself said was a circus and a disgrace.
A high-tech lynching, right?
High-tech lynching was another phrase he used. You're right. But, look, I mean, we're talking about picking people for very high office. In the case of the United States, for life. In the case of Canada, it's the age 75. And I don't think that it's asking too much to have a public process that may be even a little awkward and embarrassing sometimes. Not always, but perhaps it will be. And if people aren't prepared to go through that, then perhaps they shouldn't offer themselves as candidates for appointment. I mean, you know, democracy is not always neat and tidy. Sometimes there's a little bit of pushing and shoving. That's part of the price we pay, and it's well worth paying.
Now, Eddie Greenspan, in his review of your book in the Globe and Mail, says that you don't talk about the power of the notwithstanding clause.
Yes, he does. I mean, Mr. Greenspan attacked my book on the grounds that I didn't deal with Section 33 of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, which is the notwithstanding clause, which gives a legislature or parliament, if it's passing a statute, the ability to remove it from the ambit of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms by saying notwithstanding the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. And he thought by not dealing with Section 33, I overly emphasized the power of the Supreme Court versus the Parliament and the Executive. I'm baffled by this criticism. I don't know what was going through Mr. Greenspan's head when he wrote it, because Section 33 was put into the Charter really as a kind of a political stop to the province of Quebec. It's only really ever been used, and that only really on one serious occasion, by the province of Quebec, not by the other provinces or by the federal parliament. The last use of it was a long time ago, and there's a general consensus among legal scholars that it's a dead letter. So to seize on Section 33 and make so much of it, is, to me, a bit baffling.
He cites the O'Connor and Mills cases, which when they got to the Supreme Court, I guess the Parliament passed laws, and I guess it was in the O'Connor case, or created some policy, and the court deferred to that.
Well, I mean, certainly the Supreme Court of Canada will often explicitly defer to the legislative arm of either the province or to Parliament. I mean, there are many examples of that. I mean, the Supreme Court of Canada, I think, is very conscious of the fact that it's not an institution that can willy-nilly overrule the legislative branch. I mean, it has to be very careful about what it does. And indeed, in many judgments in which it has disallowed legislation on the grounds that it's contrary to the Charter, some of the judges have expressed concerns that the judicial function is kind of beginning to impinge on the legislative function. So I think the judges are not kind of crazy, power-hungry, power-grabbing, power-seeking individuals. They're conscious of the other branches of government. But I think to seize on Section 33 the way Mr. Greenspan did to be charitable, as I say, baffling.
Now, you mentioned the Chief Justice and the role that she's played in the court over the last 11 years or so that she's been the Chief Justice. In the book, I understand you talk about the last Chief Justice and the reason why he left. The role that they have, I mean, is that as important as the title suggests?
Probably not. I mean, the current Chief Justice, Beverly McLaughlin, is fond of saying When I became Chief Justice, they handed me the reins of power, and after a while I realized that the reins weren't attached to anything.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it is, I mean, the Chief Justice is the public spokesman for and face of the Supreme Court. The Chief Justice has certain powers by virtue of being Chief Justice. The most notable one is the ability to assign the writing of judgments to other judges, but even that's a process more often than not of, you know, of negotiation and discussion. She has, I suppose, a certain kind of moral suasion as the first among equals, but she can't tell anybody what to do. I mean, she can't tell another judge on her court, this is what you should say, this is what you must write, this is what you must do, this is what you should decide. She can't do that. So she has, or the holder of that office has a certain amount of power, but it's limited, and most of it is kind of the moral suasion power that comes from having the title Chief Justice.
And compared to previous ones, I mean, how has she done?
Well, it's always, you know, Joe, invidious to make comparisons. I mean, each one is different. She has her strengths and weaknesses, as did her predecessor, Chief Justice Lemaire. I think there's a general consensus that his predecessor, Brian Dixon, has been the outstanding Chief Justice of modern times for a variety of reasons. I would give Beverly McLaughlin a good solid B.
Graham Fraser, a few years ago, wrote a book about the bilingual nature of Canada.
Yeah, the official language.
Yeah, he became that after his book. I don't know if Mr. Harper will call you after this book, but...
I'm very, very doubtful, I would say. I'm not standing by the telephone.
Yeah. What would you suggest, though, in terms of advice that you'd give?
On the bilingualism issue?
Yeah, on that or on other things about the court.
Well, let's take the bilingualism issue. Yeah. I mean, I discussed that in Mighty Judgment. My position on that is generally rather unpopular, certainly in the legal profession. I think judges of the Supreme Court of Canada should be fully bilingual from the day of their appointment. And I mean fully bilingual. I don't mean, you know, being able to order a dinner in a French restaurant. Now, why do I say that? Well, there's a variety of reasons, but two main ones. First of all, this is a bilingual country. I mean, we've decided that. That's not up for discussion. And it follows, I think, that the highest officials in this country should be fully bilingual. I think it's accepted in the political arena now. You can't be prime minister, for example, if you're not fully bilingual. I think the same principle should apply to judges of the Supreme Court. That's kind of the theoretical reason. The practical reason is that somebody arguing in French before the court should be entirely confident that all their arguments, including the nuances and subtleties, are fully understood by the people listening and are not subject to what may or may not be a good simultaneous interpretation and translation. They do not feel this now. There are many Francophone lawyers who will tell you and will give you chapter and verse of how arguments they've made were misunderstood, mistranslated, and they generally felt at a disadvantage. To me, this is not acceptable and needs to be fixed. Now, the general response to this proposal is, no. All that matters is to pick people with the best, the highest legal merit, regardless of their linguistic ability. It's never been the only thing that matters, the people of the highest linguistic ability. For example, three of the judges have to come from Quebec by statute, by the Supreme Court Act, and the other six are chosen from across the country as a result of a constitutional convention that's grown up. So, for example, there is a British Columbia seat currently held by Beverly McLaughlin. Now, what do you think, Joe, would happen if when the British Columbia seat fell vacant, the Prime Minister said, well, I've looked around, and it turns out that the candidate with the most legal ability isn't from British Columbia at all. It's he or she is from Toronto, so I'm choosing that person. I mean, there would be howls of outrage.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's never been the case that only legal merit counts. So there's lots of people around with legal merit, and I say let's find some who are fully bilingual.
And ideally, these two appointments that he needs to fill, would you want them to come, say, one from the left and one from the right? Or?
Well, I mean, I have no particular views on that. I think what you're going to find is that they both will come from somewhere to the right of center. But there are a number of other interesting issues as well. I mean, for example, as you pointed out earlier, one of those who is retiring, Louise Chalon, a woman, obviously, I think she will have to be replaced by a woman. I don't think it will be generally thought acceptable to lower the number of women on the court by filling a seat held by a woman with a man. So that's one thing. Secondly, there's the bilingualism issue. the only judge that is generally accepted not to be bilingual on the court is Marshall Rothstein, and I think there's a feeling now that it's not acceptable for a judge to be unilingual. So there's the bilingualism issue. There is pressure to appoint the first Aboriginal to the court. There is pressure to appoint somebody directly from legal practice, as Ian Binney was appointed, to bring that kind of perspective to the court. So there's a variety of competing pressures that have nothing to do with political philosophy. But all that said and done, I don't think Prime Minister Stephen Harper is going to appoint somebody to the court that he thinks may be difficult for him later on down the road when conservative government legislation is before the court.
Finally, Philip, I collect jokes. Kate Fillion, when she interviewed you for your last book and McLean's asked you for a lawyer joke, do you have any Supreme Court jokes?
Oh, you put me on the spot. You put me on the spot now. The Supreme Court is not generally a humorous institution,
no.
Although there are some judges, notably Ian Binney, who have an excellent sense of humor that often appears in their judgments. I can give you certainly a good joke off the top of my head, but I'll think about it, and I'll call you back one day if a good one occurs to me.
Yeah, do that. Now, just about the nature these are nine people.
Yes.
Do they socialize? I mean, in the book, do you talk about them fighting and the sort?
Like, do they socialize with each other, do you mean?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think that all depends, obviously, on particular friendships or not, because there are rivalries and antagonisms as well that grow up. My general impression is there is not a whole degree of socialization that goes on. And one important thing to remember is that being a judge of the Supreme Court of Canada is not only an important job and a demanding job, it's also a lonely job, because you have to spend a lot of time in your room reading, thinking, and writing, and those are, by nature, solitary occupations.
I'm really looking forward to finishing the book, Philip. I appreciate your time today.
Not at all, Joe.
The website for more, philipslayton.com. The book is called Mighty Judgment, How the Supreme Court of Canada Runs Your Life. It's published by Allen Lane, which is an imprint of Penguin. And do check out Gab and Dad, the movie reviews on YouTube, too. Philip Slayton on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plata.